Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Infighting among Republicans over the federal budget is getting so bad that the Wall Street Journal editorial page today writes, "Hide the children because this is getting ugly." Republican moderates dug in their heels on two fronts yesterday. In the House, they rejected a vote on the party's budget plan. Then Republican senators sunk the president's plan to extend tax cuts for wealthier Americans. Meanwhile, President Bush is giving a Veterans Day speech in Pennsylvania today, pushing back against critics who say his aides twisted intelligence to justify invading Iraq. Well, with us on the line from Washington is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And John, a bad week for Republicans, is that safe to say?
Oh, Robin, that's very safe to say. You know, we not only have seen evidence on Capitol Hill of the Republican coalition flying apart. Look what happened in these elections this week when Republicans were very much hoping to capture the Virginia governor's race. New Jersey, which is, of course, a blue state, went for Kerry handily in 2004, was much more of a long shot, but they ended up losing both of them. And one of the problems is that Republicans faced a trade-off between pursuing rural voters, small-town voters, and those in the suburbs. And what happened was they went to some of their traditional mainstays, playing the death penalty, the immigration issue, and that produced a backlash in the suburbs and helped the Democrats win.
Well, and looking ahead, your newspaper has some pretty revealing poll numbers today. 39% of people surveyed said in next year's congressional elections that they'll be sending a signal of opposition to the Republican Party as well. I mean, as well as might have happened on Tuesday.
A lot to worry about for them looking forward. Now, we have to discount expectations on 2006 on this front. Most House districts are gerrymandered, so one party or the other has an advantage. That means the field of competition is relatively narrow, so that reduces prospects for Democrats in the House. However, that field may be widening. The field of competition may be widening. It may be more than we've been expecting, because when a president moves from 50%, as George W. Bush was in January, down to 38%, record low, which is where he is now, you start losing the ability to hold your party together. And once you start losing the ability to keep a unified party behind you, that creates opportunities for the other side.
Well, and you have the voters kicking up, and you have these moderate Republicans fighting over cuts in social programs, oil drilling in Alaska. But you also have Karl Rove, top confidant and aide to President Bush, making a speech this week, many who heard it saying he's back after being distracted by the Plame investigation. Is there a sense that he will get moderates back in line?
You know, there's a liberals tend to assume that Carl has diabolical powers, and conservatives tend to assume he has magical powers. But we've seen some real limits to those powers in what's happening right now. When you have an unpopular war, which is creating angst even within the Republican base, when you've got gas prices high, which makes people feel discontented about the economy, even though the overall statistics are relatively solid, when you've got turmoil over judicial nominations, and when you have a big budget deficit, you can't figure out whether you want to cut taxes or cut spending or do neither. It is very difficult to hold things together, even with somebody with a big brain like Karl Rove.
Well, and John Harwood, we only have a little less than a minute, but while we have you, I want to get your opinion on what seems to be a win for the president yesterday when senators voted 49-42 to sharply limit the access of Guantanamo detainees to U.S. courts. That bucks a Supreme Court ruling of last year that allowed detainees to challenge their detentions. Some around here were surprised that you could overrule the Supreme Court like that, but this still has to pass the House, correct?
It does. I think if it passed the Senate, the odds of it passing the House are pretty good. Even a fractious Republican majority in the House could probably get together to pass this. Look, one of the elements of good news for the president, there's been controversy recently. You know, 2004, it was Abu Ghraib. Most recently, there's been the exposure of these black prisons, these secret prisons. Over in Europe somewhere that even members of the Hill don't know too much about. But one thing we saw in the poll, when Republicans were down on every other other dimension, a majority, 55%, said they liked what the administration was
doing. I'm going to have to hold you up there, John, on that, you know, again, a negative note for the president, and revisit again next week. John Harwood, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
John is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Well, today the violence in France entered its 16th day, although last night there were 463 burned cars, down from 482 due to curfews and other emergency measures. Also today, French police tightened security in central Paris, while hundreds of residents of some of the riot-torn suburbs marched near the Eiffel Tower. At the end of these extraordinary 2 weeks, we thought we'd take the pulse of Paris, beginning with two citizens. In a moment, a member of a conservative party who advocates sending people with immigrant backgrounds who commit crimes back to their parents' country of origin. But first, a French Arab citizen who grew up in Saint-Saint-Denis, the site of much of the rioting. Journalist Nadir Dandoun is the son of an Algerian immigrant. And Nadir, we understand you have mixed feelings about your hometown of Saint-Saint-Denis.
Yeah, I grew up with a bit of hate, you know, because it was very, very poor, and someone like me didn't have the same chance than most of the people who lives in all over France. So I felt like there just was no way to have dreams or to escape.
But on the other hand, you say you also loved it.
Yeah, it's like an hate and love thing, you know. In the same place, I have never met so many nice people that where I lived, you know. Because when you are poor and when you have nothing, I think you kind of share more. You know, it's lots of solidarity where I live.
What was it like to watch Saint-Saint-Denis burning during the riots?
I had tears in my heart because, you know, it's like my own house is getting burned, you know. But then in the way, I don't like violence, you know. I think that I'm against violence. But I can understand why some kids, because mostly the guy who were on the street and burning cars, they were 15, 16, 17 years old, you know, so they are only kids. And I have to say that there was so much solidarity there when I was a kid, like when I needed sugar or when I needed a piece of meat, I just had to knock on the door to someone, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I was very, very sad, yeah.
Yeah, very sad. But also, what are kids, these 15-year-olds, telling you about why they did this?
Because they are feeling that they are not considered as a French citizen, you know. Most of the kids that I talk to telling me, look, we don't have our place here, you know. We are constantly arrested by the cops, you know, getting checked, you know, for, like, nothing.
We understand you talked about the kids saying that they get pulled aside arbitrarily by police, that there's a phrase, a slang phrase in Parisian.
Le délit de sale gueule. It means that if you have black skin, you are more chance to get arrested by the cops.
We understand that phrase is the offense of a dirty mug, a dirty face.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What do you see, Nadir, happening in the near future and the far future?
You know, I have to say that I am pretty pessimistic, you know. If the French government doesn't do something about it, it may be explode again. And this time it may get worse.
Nadir, you talk about what the French government needs to do, what French society needs to do. I'm just wondering, what do you think the Muslim community needs to do?
I think the point is, if you don't have equality of chance, you have extremism. Hmm. That's true, you know. That's all, you know.
Nadir Dandoun speaking to us in Saint-Saint-Denis, just north of Paris. Nadir, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much to you.
So a French Arab citizen says the lack of equality of chance leads to extremists. Well, we turn now to Jean-Michel Girard. He's the director of foreign affairs for Front National, the right-wing party led by Jean-Marie Le Pen, who has long been anti-immigration, feels vindicated now, and says that people with immigrant backgrounds who commit crimes should be sent back to their parents' country of origin, and if they are French citizens, stripped of their citizenship. Well, we ask you to listen closely to Mr. Girard. We've caught him on his cell phone. Mr. Girard, what do you think is fueling the riots?
The problem is that when you have unqualified, and by unqualified I mean not in terms of work, but in terms of immigrants, and you have uncontrolled immigration in a country like France or the UK or Germany, I mean, you are going to encounter some problems. First of all, the structure in France is not geared to be be able to handle these immigrants.
So are you saying, Jean-Michel Girard, that it's not the immigrants' fault that they do want to assimilate, but it's the government's fault for not being better prepared to accept immigrants?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the immigrants are coming into France with some kind of an illusion that it's going to be wonderful, better from where they come from, which is true as far as many African countries are concerned, or most African countries are concerned. But I think that it is totally unfair on the present government, or the previous governments for the past 30 years, you know, to accept people when you know that the structures are not ready to be able to welcome those people. Part of our program towards Africa is for people to come into France. Everybody has got the right of education, and to actually get qualified in France, and after 4 or 5 years, to actually go back to their country and actually promote their skills, get a job, and create a business, and actually create wealth in their country.
So you're saying that there aren't enough jobs, or there's not an infrastructure to put these people to work in France. They should be trained and sent back to their home country. But what do you say to critics who say that there's a racist element here, that people in Paris, for instance, don't want Muslims and Arabs working there, that there are jobs there, there are opportunities, they're just not offered to these to this population?
Well, I don't know where you get your figures from, but all I can tell you is that right now unemployment in France is between 10% and 15%, and that's from the point of view of all levels, might it be immigrants or actually French people. And it's not a question of racism; it is just a question that there is no jobs.
Well, now, Mr. Girard, Mr. Le Pen says that people with immigrant backgrounds who commit crimes should be sent back to their country of origin, and if French, they should be stripped of their nationality. Is he aware that the majority of young people in the rioting are French-born in France to legal immigrants? Do you think that they should be sent back?
Absolutely. What we believe in, and I think it's quite a sane approach, is that now, you have a majority of people who have been totally integrated and totally assimilated and who actually are a very good part of the electorate. Now, these people want to protect what they have. If you get them on the radio, I mean, they will tell you, I am French, I am proud to be French, and anyone, doesn't matter who it is, a French person or an immigrant person who is prepared to destroy that security for me, must go back. And I totally agree with them. When you come to France and you are a citizen of this country, you must be prepared to not only have the right to be French, but you have some duties. And those people are not prepared to respect the duties of the environment or the culture, which makes them the French way of life.
Jean-Michel Girard, the Director of Foreign Affairs for Front National, the Conservative Party led by Jean-Marie Le Pen, speaking to us from his cell phone. Thank you very much, Mr. Girard.
My pleasure.
So, a conservative who feels even children of immigrants who are French citizens should be sent to Africa if they commit crimes? Should white French people who commit crimes also be deported? And what other questions are being raised by the riots? We'll explore with a French woman who studies Muslim immigration in all of Europe. That's coming up next. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Well, one of the biggest questions people in France are asking this week is, why are these young people rioting? Are they angry about the lack of jobs and opportunities, as we just heard? Or are they rioting out of a sense of Muslim identity and a rejection of French secular society? Jocelyn Cesari is with us now in the studio. She's an expert on Muslim immigration in France. She usually teaches at the Sorbonne in Paris, but this year is a visiting professor at Harvard. And, Professor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And we know you just came back from Europe, where you spoke to people in France about the riots as well as speaking in Europe. How big a role is religion playing in the violence? Because we just heard from two people from the left and the right saying, no, it's about jobs.
It's true that it's not about religion. The young men that are who are rioting are not doing it on a religious basis. I have talked to religious leaders in France who try to calm them down and to use religious arguments to calm them down, and they are not revolting on religious ground. It's really a rebellion, of course, of excluded disenfranchised people, but because of a long history of this particular migration. It's, of course, exclusion, jobs, but not only. They are the descendant of a special immigration in France. France is based, built up on immigration.
Because these were people from former French colonies.
Exactly. And this does make a difference. Since their parents came and since they became citizens, because the French law is very open and liberal. You get French citizenship if you are born in France.
But we hear people from the National Front Party, Le Pen's party, saying that's the problem. It's too liberal.
Yeah, but the people sometimes of the National Front are themselves descendant of immigrants. Mm. You know, this is the kind of paradox that's going on in the political scene. But having said that, these people have always been seen as separate, different. They have always been targeted because of their ethnic and cultural origin.
Can you explain that a little bit for us? Because we're reading today again that in France, it's so important just to be called a Frenchman that they don't even take a or they don't even ask on a census what your background is. That you're not,
absolutely,
don't speak of it.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right. The French tradition is not, as I hear here and there, a tradition of integration, respecting cultural differences. It's a tradition of assimilation. And it worked pretty well for Italian, Spanish, Polish. You know, this is the basis of French population. It doesn't work well for people coming from the former colonies, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and Africa.
Why not?
Because they have been singled out since the beginning, meaning first their parents came, they became part of the labor force in France, but they didn't want them to stay. There were a question of using them to rebuild France after the Second World War, but the cultural religious dimension of this influx has never been thought through. First in France, but also in the countries of origin that were just built up their new nations after decolonization. So on both sides, there was sort of resistance to accept the consequences, the cultural consequences of that.
I want to ask you more about that just before we move on, because there are some who say, well, this is the fault of the Muslim Arab community, that they don't want to assimilate, that they want to keep to their culture. And you're, you know, nodding your head, but just address that perception, if nothing else, that the fault lies there as well.
There is a mutual resistance, meaning it's true that the parents and grandparents of the young men who are rioting now have said to their children, please don't, you know, you are not in your country. And some of these parents have fought against the French colonial power in France, you know. So this is the kind of thing that have been going on, a sort of resistance. We are just here to make money and go back. So it's true that there was this kind of discourse going on in some families. But since the 80s, the 1980s, what happened is the brother and sisters of the people who are rioting now, they start also rioting. They also burned cars in the 80s in France. And this was what called at the time the Arab generation, using a slang word, French slang word called beurre. Mm. At this time also there was this kind of emergence. But since that time, nothing has been improved.
You know, Professor Sadari, I want to ask you, you said as we began that unlike what most people think outside of France and some in France, this is not about religion.
No.
But we're hearing, for instance, Nadir Dandoun that we spoke with, he told me that when he was younger and lived in Saint-Saint-Denis, he referred to himself as Arab. Now the kids refer to themselves as Muslim. And we hear about all the blogs and the text messaging coming from outside of France, urging these kids on, saying that you don't belong to France, you belong to the caliphate across Europe, you don't belong to one country. If it didn't start because of religion, is it going to religion?
For now, it would be very premature to conclude anything. What I can tell you is that the terms Muslim, Arab, North African, Algerian, immigrant are used in a complete indistinctive way in the French political discourse, intellectual discourse, and of course by the young men and young women themselves. I mean, they don't disconnect the religious identity from the national, racial, cultural identity.
And that's new for Frenchmen.
Yeah, it's new for this particular group. It's not. It started with this confusion, and we are paying now the cost of this confusion.
We only have about a minute left, but what has to happen in your mind?
I think that there is a real effort to be done on the political side to change the communication. These people, they suffer about financial or material alienation, but they also suffer from symbolic alienation. They want to be part of mainstream France, and there is a way maybe to reconcile them with France through another way of communicating, not calling them names like some people did or politicians did in the beginning, being able to acknowledge their presence and to open up some spaces of dialogue with them.
Yeah. Jocelyn Cesari, a visiting professor at Harvard University, an expert on immigration in France and all of Europe. And by the way, her book is When Islam and Democracy Meet, Muslims in Europe and the U.S. And we'd like to have you back to talk about
Thank
that
you.
Last part of
I
your
hope,
expertise.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thank you.
Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And this note, next week on Here and Now, budget politics on Capitol Hill. We'll see if a group of renegade Republicans can push through their agenda. Also, the poem that defined a generation, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, 50 years old. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's a catch-22 in the nursing field. There are currently 126,000 unfilled nursing positions in hospitals across the country, and it's estimated that by the year 2015, the U.S. will have a shortage of 1 million nurses. In recent years, more people have been looking to nursing as a career, but the problem is the shortage of experienced nurses has led to a shortage of instructors. So last year, 35,000 qualified applicants were turned away from nursing schools across the country because there was no one to teach them. Well, we're joined in the studio by Judith Schindel Rothschild. She's an associate professor at the Boston College School of Nursing. And Professor, have you had to turn people away? Is this a problem at Boston College?
It's a problem across all nursing schools in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's estimated that about 20% of nursing schools in Massachusetts had to turn away qualified applicants because they didn't have sufficient faculty to supervise them in the clinical area or classrooms.
Yeah, so this is happening even in places that some might consider a very desirable place for people to teach and for nurses to study. Why do you think there are less instructors, in addition to the fact that there is an overall shortage?
The main reason is retirement. All nurses across the country, regardless of position, are older on average than they were several decades ago. In faculty positions, most nurses are retiring around the age of 61. The average age for faculty is in the mid-50s, so you can see that we're rapidly losing our faculty labor force. There aren't younger nurses coming in the pipeline to replace those faculty. So we have a gap between those leaving the academic ranks and potential people who can fill those positions. We're doing our best to encourage nurses to move forward in their education, to matriculate into master's programs and PhD programs as fast as they can.
But we understand you're coming across another problem in another area, actually, academia. That a nurse may not be as tempting for a practicing nurse to go into academics. Why?
Well, I supervise students in the clinical area. I also teach in the classroom at Boston College undergraduates in psychiatric nursing. And I'm responsible for finding clinical faculty to supervise them in agencies. On average, nurses who supervise students make between $4,000 and $7,000 for supervising a group of 6 or 8 students. That doesn't come close to what they could earn making $30 to sometimes $50 an hour with overtime in a clinical setting. So the salary gap is substantial for part-time faculty.
We understand that a 2003 survey found that nurse practitioners earned on average $20,000 more than nurse professors and both have the same master's degree.
Absolutely. So that there's that gap that's substantial, and there's no evidence that that salary gap is going to change anytime soon. I think in ambulatory care settings and hospitals, nurses have been quite effective throughout the latter part of the 90s and into the last few years in improving their salaries and benefits. We have not seen that kind of response in academia at all. So we are seeing people turn us down. We're doing the best we can to bring faculty in. I was joking before the broadcast today that I had to double the number of clinical faculty I had for this fall semester from last fall. And I called every friend of mine that I've ever worked with for the past 20 years and said, please come and do us a favor and supervise
because
our students.
Because you have so many applicants.
We doubled my enrollments for the fall semester this past semester that we're in right now, doubled from the previous year.
Now, why do you think that is?
For nursing students in particular, the knowledge that they can graduate and start in a work setting making around $55,000. In studies that have been done, our graduates from the School of Nursing start at a salary that's substantially higher than other graduates from other schools within, for instance, Boston College, Arts and Sciences, or Management. So the students see that as a real benefit. What they don't realize, the other important stride we've made in salaries for nurses, is that now in many institutions like Brigham and Women's Hospital, the career ladder where they can end their career in terms of their salary is roughly double what they get when they enter. That's what it should be for all professions and careers. So we have achieved that great benefit of having an expanded career ladder. You don't see that in academia. What I get as a starting salary is not double what I will get when I retire. It's not even close.
So we come full circle to the catch-22. And I'm wondering, so given that nurses now know, nurse practitioners now know that their salaries will be increased as they work, but professors know theirs won't. How do you get nurses to cross over?
It's very, very difficult. I mean, I think you have to. What we've done is tried to sell the role as offering other opportunities in your career, opportunities for research, for scholarship, for leadership within the profession. So that's what we're trying to sell. Ultimately, we are going to have to improve the salaries and benefits, hands down.
Well, now we know that some of the $10 million from Congress in grants is being used to boost salaries of professors in some cases. But what else can be done? What else can government do? Can the profession do?
Well, for myself, I look at myself as an example of why did I decide to pursue advanced education. And it was because I got traineeships from the federal government, the National Institute of Mental Health, to get my graduate degree at Yale. And then I got another scholarship from the National Institute of Mental Health to pursue a doctorate at Boston College in sociology. Financial aid makes a tremendous difference. Unlike other academics, nurses tend to get their doctorates in mid-career, 40s and 50s. And if you consider that we're retiring at 61, that's a very truncated time that they're available. So we have shifted our philosophy, encouraging young, promising men and women to matriculate from the baccalaureate to the master's, straight through to the doctorate, so that they finished with the academic credentials they need around the same time that most academics do, which is in late 20s, early 30s, the same as medicine, for instance. Then you have at least 2 or 3 decades that the person can dedicate to their scholarship and their research and to teaching.
So you want to get them young.
We do.
Yeah. Judith Schindel Rothschild, an associate professor at the Boston College School of Nursing, talking about not the shortage of nursing applicants, but the shortage of nursing instructors. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. And still to come, a new book pairs archival photographs from the Civil War with contemporary pictures taken of the battlegrounds today to a profound effect. You won't believe how some of these sacred grounds are now being used. You're listening to Here and Now. On Sunday, a Major League Championship title is on the line in Frisco, Texas, and we are playing this thrilling music for the benefit of our own Bill Littlefield, who sometimes has to celebrate soccer championships all by himself.
I gave a party and nobody came.
No, I have to say, Bill Littlefield, of course, of NPR's Only a Game, you are so adorable in your Revolution, New England Revolution getup that you're wearing in honor, I suppose, of this weekend's festivities.
You probably wouldn't believe this was just the shirt that I happened to put my hand on in the closet this morning.
Oh, no, I wouldn't.
Okay.
I think you got all dressed up. You got the whole outfit on.
Absolutely.
Because the New England Revolution is taking on the Los Angeles Galaxy. These two teams, as we all know, split head-to-head games during the regular season. Though the Revolution does have a better overall record, and as you all know, Bill, I'm telling a lot of people this for the first time. Tell us again why soccer is so thrilling and has so caught your imagination.
Well, it's caught my imagination for a whole bunch of reasons, Robin. One is I got to coach my children playing it.
Mm-hmm.
One is that both the women's national team and the WUSA and, to some extent, of course, the Revolution for the past 10 years have been so welcoming when I've gone out there to do stories. The general managers return my phone calls. The players chase after me in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, talk to me, too. Mm-hmm. So it's hard not to be flattered into caring in that kind of situation. But the game itself is a terrific game.
It's a terrific game, and my cousins drive down from Vermont, those of you outside the state, they cross three states to come stay with me to watch the Revolution play because they feel so welcomed as fans.
Absolutely.
But here we have New England and Los Angeles playing a championship in Texas.
Right. Frisco, Texas, which is the home field of FC Dallas, the Major League Soccer club there. And the reason is that it is one of the places where they have built a soccer-friendly stadium, a stadium built for soccer rather than, for example, Gillette Stadium, which houses a soccer team as its decidedly secondary tenant.
Mostly has the New England Patriots
mm-hmm.
in it. Well, but, you know, there's great news about the sport because it's been so open to fans and reporters alike. But the league has lost more than $300 million in 10 years that it's been here. Television ratings have declined since the first season. Average attendance is down?
Well, average attendance is up and down.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little down from last season, but up from a couple of seasons ago. So I don't think that's an important statistic. And for every negative statistic, there is a positive. They have the league has recently signed the biggest sponsorship deal in its history with Adidas. There is a more a widespread ownership. It's not as concentrated as it used to be. More and more teams are building soccer-specific stadiums, which tremendously increase the kind of identity of a team and the ability of the likelihood that fans will identify it and support it. And all of these are very positive signs.
Well, so here we have the New England Revolution and the L.A. Galaxy going for the U.S. Pro Championship. By the way, what do you think is going to happen this weekend?
I think we're going to see a very interesting game. These teams have a history. Each team has a very recognizable sort of matinee idol superstar, Taylor Twellman on the Revolution and Landon Donovan for the Galaxy. Both of them, of course, recognizable players and upfront strikers, guys who teams count on to score. So that makes for kind of an interesting contrast. But the beautiful thing about soccer is, who knows? I mean, it could be 6-5, and it could be 1-0.
And whoever wins, will they be taken seriously by the world's champions?
Well, this is the American League, the Major League Soccer, does not have the quality that the more established, long-standing leagues do. If Manchester United were to play an important game against the MLS champion, who would win? Well, Manchester United, more often than not. Likewise, Real Madrid and Barcelona and Juventus. But I think that because there have been more American players playing overseas, the quality of the game certainly has improved. The last World Cup, the American team performed brilliantly and did the best it's ever done. So the day may come when they'll challenge the best.
You keep hoping.
I will do that.
NPR's Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, by the way. Listen to him this weekend for soccer and much, much more. And Bill, we play this song for you as well.
I very much appreciate it, Robin. Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some of the sounds from the annual Veterans Day ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery this morning as Vice President Dick Cheney laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns. The last living veteran of the Civil War died in 1958, but the conflict that divided the nation more than 140 years ago continues to resonate today. And now a new book juxtaposes historical photographs of Civil War battlefields with contemporary pictures of the sites today. The photos are on display at the DeCordova Museum in Lincoln, Massachusetts, but you can also see many of them right now on our website, here-now.org, as we talk about them with John Huddleston. He's a professor of art at Middlebury College in Vermont. He joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
You said that these Civil War battlefields are talisman. Why do they have such resonance for you?
First of all, the Civil War is the central pivotal event in the United States history. I also began walking these battlefields with my father, who was a career Army officer at a pretty young age, some of the battlefields in Virginia, and they're such beautiful places full of such terrible memories that I was confused. So I started working slowly with the photographs, and it started meaning more and more to me. I started learning more about the war and the consequences of the war, and they're just very important places.
Well, what do you mean you were confused? Confused that so many could have died, or confused that so little attention is being paid to the fields now?
Well, those things, but I guess confused with the beauty of the battlefields as they exist now and the terrible carnage that went down in those places.
Yeah, let's remind ourselves. I'm on page 108, and what you've done here is you've juxtaposed on the left side the original plates, and I'm looking at an 1863 photograph from Gettysburg in Pennsylvania of the Union dead in the foreground, a soldier with his mouth agape, you know, dozens of bodies sprinkled across this field. And on the opposite page, your photograph of the same field with, what am I seeing?
The modern photograph is outside of Gettysburg College, and it depicts tackling dummies and blocking dummies for their football team.
Hmm. What are you saying with that juxtaposition?
There's the young man's spirit of conflict, competition, the macho thing is happening here. And there are a lot of analogies that football players make to war, which I think are a little silly. So I guess that would be one of the connections that happens between these pictures.
Because as you note on the modern photograph, on a caption, there were over 51,000 casualties on that field, injuries and deaths. So many deaths. I mean, these places are blood-soaked.
620,000 soldiers were killed in the Civil War on both sides, and that figure actually surpasses the combined total of all other American wars. Mm. Just unbelievable.
I turn the page, and there are two photographs from the time, around 1862, of amputated feet. Tell us a little bit about how these pictures came to be, because you include some of the biographies of the Civil War era photographers.
I include a lot of these. The medical doctors, I mean, photography had become a workable process. I mean, the Civil War was the first war that was really documented in an extensive manner because photography was a practical process at that point. The surgeons who were experimenting with different techniques of amputation, bone excisions, also documented their work and followed up their work with photography to explain to other doctors and to, you know, keep track of patients. Many of these wounded pictures come from the Army Medical Museum, the Otis Archives in Washington, D.C. Mm. But what I don't understand is these pictures are so available. There are so many veterans depicted of amputees of particular battles, but you very rarely see them in Civil War books. And I think that's because we still tend to want to romanticize that conflict or end up in sort of, you know, examining the tactics, that type of stuff, instead of really dealing with the cost of that war, you know, which is the cost of all wars.
You put in a lot of the photographs of the soldiers photographed after they were killed, which is startling. A lot of the photos deal with race. I'm on page 86. And again, listeners can go to our website, here-now.org. It's an historical wedding on Jefferson Davis's plantation. You see several black slaves looking at the camera, dressed in what's probably their finest. The juxtaposition for you is a contemporary photo of a hotel in Mississippi, which has a lawn jockey in front of it of an African-American. Other photographs have a road with racial slurs scribbled on the asphalt, juxtaposed with an image of a slave market in Atlanta. What are you saying about those juxtapositions regarding race?
The Civil War was a step forward, certainly in freeing the slaves, but it did not end the problem by any means, and it's still very current with us in the South and certainly in the North. And the book points to other things that sort of cycle through. I mean, in Vicksburg, there's a photograph of Army reservists actually taking a tour of the battlefield in uniform who were bound for the first war in Iraq. So another cycle that seems to, unfortunately, continue through human history.
There's another photograph that you have here. On page 104, it's in Andersonville, Georgia. On the left side is an old photograph of a prison for captured soldiers, and you see thousands of bedraggled men crowded together. Your contemporary photo, though, is just of the sky above where the prison was.
The sky is a very strong presence there. It's sort of a flat field where the prison yard was. The wounded soldiers, the dying soldiers would have been turned towards the sky. It's also tremendously hot down there, hot and humid and very sort of oppressive sky.
And you speak of prisoners, which we see quite a few prisoners of war pictures through the book. But look at this, page 154. I'm looking at a photo of a released prisoner of war. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen a picture like this come out of America's Civil War. He looks as if he had been at Buchenwald.
Yes, I was struck by that comparison also. I mean, just terrible treatment on both sides. Some of the prisons in the North were also very, very terrible places for these men to be.
What do you think America should do about these sites? Because many of them are also the modern-day sites are, you know, gas stations, toxic waste dumps, places where Americans died.
They fought in so many places. I think there were 10,000 sites that were fought over. It's obviously very difficult to preserve all of those. And in some cities, like the picture where the Kmart has replaced one of the earthen forts, that's kind of terrible, and it's probably pretty terrible what it says about our country. But I hope we can have some enlightened conservation on some of the big battlefields like Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg, which are also in this book, which are fast disappearing under development pressure in Virginia.
John Huddleston is author of the book Killing Ground, Photographs of the Civil War and the Changing American Landscape. He's also a professor at Middlebury College, and he spoke to us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. John, thank you. And remember that you can see many of the photos on our website, here-now.org, or in the Boston area, you can see them on display at the DeCordova Museum in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again. We're going to leave you today with the playing of taps from today's Veterans Day ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.